Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 30th of March 1924, Singapore and strikes. Just like last week. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance or sloth. Correspondents have been complaining about French police treatment of English tourists. There was an article on Turkish headgear, another on Catalonian separatism, and further correspondence on the merits of becoming a doctor, along the lines of, do put your son in the operating theatre, Mr. Worthington. That, in case you didn't know, is a reference to the song Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, Mrs. Worthington, by Noel Coward, whose review at London Calling has just opened. But first, or should that be second, this week's big stories. The London bus and tram strike looks like it is coming to an end. It has, however, provoked a great deal of wailing and gnashing of teeth, with statists of many stripes claiming that it proves the need for the government to coordinate transport in London. There have been landslips in Amalfi in Italy. Over 100 have died. Robert Nivelle, the man behind the ill-starred and eponymous offensive that led to widespread mutinies in the French army in 1917, has died. Following the pressure on his position I mentioned in the 16th of March episode, the US Attorney General has resigned, becoming the latest victim of the Teapot Dome scandal. A Japanese steamer has sunk in the channel. 23 sailors are missing. The Sutlej, the former HMS Sutlej, a Royal Navy cruiser, has arrived in Belfast to be broken up. Not normally a story, but on her way there from Rosyth, it parted from her tugs and spent several weeks adrift in the North Sea, along with her 13-man crew. Another naval vessel on her way to the scrapyard is the Empress, the former HMS Revenge, one of the last wooden battleships in the Royal Navy. The Norwegian government has recommended that prohibition is abolished. I must confess that I didn't know that they ever had prohibition, but there you go. There's been a correspondence on whether cars should be equipped with rear-view mirrors. An Englishwoman on holiday in Italy went up a mountain, got lost, and was shot dead by a sentry guarding an army base. It looks like Waterloo Bridge will have to be rebuilt due to pier subsidence. There's been a demonstration of a new type of colour film. George Bernard Shaw's new play, St. Joan, has received its premiere in London. There's been a debate over whether MPs should have free rail travel between Westminster and their constituencies. And in an advertisement, the coal industry claims that it makes a grand total of 0.75 profit on every 100 weight it sells. That's about 1/1600th of a troy ounce of gold. I saw this in Monday's edition. The Chief Constable of Birkenhead, reporting on police recruits, deplores the lack of a better type of man for the force and says that educated men are needed. Only 8 of 70 applicants recently passed all the tests. If you're looking for a smart policeman in 1924, you may find one in your local bookshop. This is from Tuesday. Poirot Investigates, by Agatha Christie, author of The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, The Murder on the Links, etc., just out. A new and fascinating detective novel by one of the acknowledged masters of the craft of mystery fiction. That's an ad, by the way. Poirot Investigates is a collection of short stories, one of which is The Kidnapped Prime Minister, in which the Prime Minister goes to France and is kidnapped by Irish Republicans. Oddly enough, in 1922, the Times reported, and I didn't, that a French author had claimed that he had been kidnapped by Irish Republicans in France. Twice. A shindig, apparently unaffected by the bus and tram strike, was held to celebrate Churchill's defeat in the Abbey by-election last week. What, one wonders, will they do if he ever actually wins? I saw this from the Times' report. The Duke of Marlborough, in proposing Mr. Churchill's health, said that when he saw Mr. Churchill come out as an independent candidate in the Abbey division to grapple with the socialist forces, he had once said, "This is not a party question. The party machine must be put on one side. This is a national question. Mr. Churchill fought a brave and noble fight, and they wished him long life and a career marked by still greater political success and achievement. We believe, he said, turning to Mr. Churchill, that wisdom and policy will teach you to do that which destiny dictates, and that you will go where the irrevocable trend of events must ultimately lead you. What prophetic words, I thought, until I realised that the Duke is Churchill's cousin. And then I realised that makes no difference. They are still prophetic words. Talking of men of destiny, the final statements have been given in the Beer Hall Putsch treason trial. This is from Friday. For the first time since the beginning of the trial, General Ludendorff made an appeal on personal grounds. It was a dignified, impressive plea from a soldier who for 30 years had served his country to the utmost of his capacity. He said, "For the third time before the whole world, I speak a solemn warning. If the spirit of patriotism in Germany is crushed, then we are lost, lost forever. We must be prepared for a Versailles that will be far worse than that we have already suffered, and we must remain a permanently enslaved country, an outcast from the ranks of the free nations of the world." To which I am inclined to add, if the spirit of patriotism is not crushed, you will have to prepare for a Versailles that will be far worse, and for becoming an outcast from the ranks of the free nations of the world. Oh, and the other guy, Ludendorff's sidekick, the one with the moustache. Did he have anything to say? General Ludendorff's speech was followed by a display of rhetorical fireworks from Herr Hitler, and the sitting then concluded. Whatever Hitler may or may not have said, it seems to have had an effect. This is from Saturday. Herr von Kahr, General von Lossow and Colonel von Seisser left Bavaria this morning for Italy, owing, it is said, to the state of their health. These were the three who put down the rebellion. Now, just in case you are wondering, that is a lie. They're not ill. They're going to Italy out of fears for their personal safety. The London bus and tram strike has led to the setting up of a court of inquiry, a sort of public inquiry, to look into the strikers' claims. This is from Monday the 24th. Mr. Frank Pick of the London General Omnibus Company, and a bit of a legend in the history of London transport, said there were between 22,000 and 25,000 omnibus men idle. The present rates for conductors upon omnibuses were 73 shillings 6 pence minimum, rising to 79 shillings 6 pence after 6 months. The corresponding wages on tramways were 58 shillings and 67 shillings, maximum after 2 years. The drivers of omnibuses received a minimum of 80 shillings 6 pence and a maximum, after 6 months, of 86 shillings 6 pence. The corresponding figures on the tramways were 58 shillings minimum and 67 shillings maximum after 2 years. That is quite the difference for what I presume is much the same job. So, how would they translate into today's money? I presume these are weekly wages, in which case 86 shillings a week is 4,300 shillings per annum, which is £215 per annum, which would buy you in those days about 43 ounces of gold, which would buy you today £73,000. We have to apply the Crozier fudge factor, because the pound is massively overvalued at the moment, which gets us down to £36,000. My heart bleeds. Mr. Pick proceeded to explain how last year efforts were made to coordinate the services of omnibuses and the tramways of the companies, and said when the tramways were suffering badly, they withdrew some of the omnibuses on certain routes, hoping that this would give the tramways a chance to live. But unfortunately, when they withdrew their omnibuses, privately owned omnibuses were put on the routes, with the result that there was just as much competition as there was when the omnibuses of the General Omnibus Company were running. People don't want to use trams. Ernest Bevin, leader of the trade union, whom I mentioned in the 24th of February episode, cross-examined Lord Ashfield, Pick's boss. "Mr. Bevin, I want to ask whether, up to a certain period, you held the view that omnibuses would ultimately supersede tramways." Lord Ashfield: "No." "That's got to be a lie. He must know that the trams are done for." He was then asked about state ownership. Lord Ashfield, clearly the present methods for dealing with passenger transport in London cannot possibly secure to the public, to the employees, or to those who have invested money in these undertakings a satisfactory position. Clearly the situation as it is now must inevitably end in disaster, and I use that rather exaggerated expression after careful consideration, because it is not only a question of tramways. Tramways cannot continue to go on under the present circumstances. If the position goes on, it will be impossible for the omnibuses to continue to meet even their current expenses, and with regard to the underground railways, it is equally true of them. You can have competition in almost every other form of industry, but you cannot have competition in transport in its widest sense, because every form of transport must operate. Huh? Every form of transport must operate? Like horse-drawn cabs, for instance? He can't mean that, surely. This is special pleading. My industry is quite unlike all the others and therefore must have a massive government subsidy. See also healthcare, education, books, etc. But there's even more bad news for trams. Mr. L. Slattery, manager of the West Ham Tramways, said that for the year ending March 31st, the trading loss would be in the region of £16,500. To that, they had to add £5,000, the corporation's contribution to the superannuation fund, and £24,000 for reconstruction. Whatever that may be. And it's not getting any better. At this time, some trams were privately owned and some state-owned. A bit like trains in Tokyo today. But you knew that. The London County Council, which covers the very centre of the city, also runs a service. Not very well, if memory serves. But things could be worse. This is from Wednesday. Mr. Emil Davis, chairman of the Labour Party in the council, they're in opposition at the moment, said he thought it was futile to say that the tramway service could not afford to pay the increase asked for by the men. How many public services could show a profit? They would never get peace in the transport industry of London until those services were treated as public services only. Whatever that is. On the basis of experience, public service appears to mean run-down infrastructure, delays, overcrowding, indifference, poor service, and technological backwardness. The Court of Inquiry issued an interim report on Tuesday, which included this statement. All parties express the view, with which we concur, that without some coordinating control of passenger traffic within the metropolitan area, there is little, if any, prospect of improvement in the condition of the industry. Sounds ominous. More ominous was the London Traffic Bill that the government introduced. Under Clause 6, any licensing authority in the area may, with a view to securing public safety and the convenience of the traffic, define the routes on which omnibus services may be run. It may further be made a condition that an omnibus shall not ply except in maintaining a regular service. The authority may also demand information as to the time at which an omnibus service is to begin and end on each day, the service to be maintained on the route, and the maximum number of omnibuses to be used to maintain such a service. So goodbye to competition and flexibility. This in the week that the only bus service of any description was being provided by the so-called pirates. Meanwhile, Londoners just have to make the best of it. This is from Wednesday. The weather of yesterday made the transport strike a serious reality for many Londoners who had imagined they might endure its hardships without ill effects. A resolution formed at the beginning of the strike to walk 3 or 4 miles to a place of business was badly shaken by the rain and stuffiness of yesterday. Yet for large numbers of people, there was no alternative. The results were such as a strike organiser might approve. Despite the variety of weather which Londoners have learned to expect in the course of the year, customary transport facilities seem to have eradicated the habit of preparing literally against a rainy day. The truth of this was evident yesterday, especially among the women workers. Shoes made more with the object of doing full justice to expensive hosiery were still doing duty, though a walk was inevitable, and the thoroughfares were coated with liquid mud. There must have been many damp feet in the lighted offices of the city. The Labour government's decision to abandon plans to build a naval base at Singapore has not gone down well. The Navy League has held a meeting with Lord Curzon, Lord Carson, Winston Churchill, him again, and Leo Amery in attendance. By my reckoning, that's three former First Lords of the Admiralty. The meeting has also received letters from Stanley Baldwin, former Prime Minister, and Lord Milner, former War Minister. This is what Churchill had to say. Many forces had combined to build up the British Commonwealth of Nations. He was far from contending that material forces had outweighed moral forces, but moral forces, the genius of our race, our laws, our language, our sense of justice and toleration, all these great title deeds, which had given Britain her inheritance, would never have achieved their result, would never have found their physical expression, had it not been for the protection given to the whole empire at all times by the Royal Navy. Any decision to abandon the Singapore base left Australia and New Zealand to whatever fate an anxious and inscrutable future might have in store. I suspect he doesn't mean a future dominated by the inscrutable Americans, even if that is how it turned out. It was an act of repudiation. It was an act of ungraceful desertion. It was a plain refusal, without precedent in the history of our mother country, to discharge an imperial duty. He did have a way with words. I mention him a lot, and sometimes I think I mention him too much. But the Times mentions him a lot, and this well before his finest hour. And he's not even an MP. But he has a way to get people to listen to what he is saying. He is box office. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.